Greetings and welcome to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. On today's program, we'll talk with journalist John Ross about the Mexican government's ongoing campaign against foreign observers in Chiapas. He'll also tell us about other developments in Mexico, including the raging forest fires that have devastated thousands of acres of land throughout the country. We'll also take a brief look at the May 31st presidential elections in Colombia with correspondent Steve Dudley and hear from the Center for Defense Information about the potential for an arms race in Latin America. Later in the program, we'll take a look at oil exploration in Latin America by making a comparison between Texaco's devastation of the Ecuadorian Amazon and Occidental's attempt to explore for oil in indigenous territory in Colombia. All of this and more coming up next, but first here are some stories making headlines this week in Our Americas.
With news from Our Americas, I'm Sarah Gill.
And I'm Walter Krugman. In Argentina, pardoned junta leader Jorge Videla is being called to give evidence regarding the 1976 disappearances of two guerrilla leaders. Mario Santucho and Benito Urteaga were both leaders of the People's Revolutionary Party, or ERP, which was wiped out in the military's dirty war against leftists and suspected sympathizers. Both disappeared within 4 months of the coup, led by then-army chief Videla, that toppled the government of Isabela Perón. An Argentine court is investigating so that the bodies of Santucho and Urteaga can be traced and returned to their families. Lawyers for the families said that they requested Videla's testimony after another former army general admitted that he had been officially informed on July 19, 1976, that the heads of the ERP had been killed in an operation, unquote, the army's euphemism for torture and murder. Videla, like all the top junta leaders, has amnesty under a 1989 law passed by President Saúl Menem. He will be appearing as a witness in June, but runs no risk of being jailed for human rights atrocities committed during the junta's 1976 to 1983 regime.
In related news, Argentine President Saúl Menem has started his five-day spin around Scandinavia to the sounds of Swedish boos and heckles. Argentine and Swedish human rights groups staged a rally outside the Argentine embassy in Stockholm to protest Menem's pardon for junta leaders whose dirty war victims included a 15-year-old Swedish girl. Dagmar Hagelin was kidnapped in Buenos Aires in 1977 by a death squad from the Navy School of Mechanics, the ESMA, one of the most infamous torture centers of the 1976 to 1983 dictatorship. Participating in the rally was the rights group Hijos, made up of the teenage sons and daughters of the disappeared. They are demanding the annulment of Menem's amnesty laws and the retrial of the junta leaders and death squad members. In January 1997, on the 20th anniversary of Hagelin's disappearance, the Swedish Parliament sent an official request to the Argentine Congress to get the courts to investigate her case properly.
In Mexico, President Ernesto Zedillo is changing his strategy of expelling human rights observers from Chiapas. He's just not going to let them in the first place. Human rights groups blasted Zedillo on May 25th for refusing a visa to Ted Lewis, director of San Francisco-based Global Exchange, an organization that takes part in electoral and human rights monitoring and arranges educational tours to trouble spots. Lewis was not granted a visa on the grounds that the Mexican government has established new rules, including a 60-day waiting period. Applicants must also prove that they are, quote, professional human rights activists. Several Mexican rights groups are challenging the decision as possibly illegal because Zedillo's new rules have not yet been approved by the Senate and are therefore unconstitutional. Some 60 foreigners have been ejected from conflicted Chiapas this year alone. We'll have more on Mexico later on in the program.
Nicaragua's opposition party has been rocked by charges of sexual assault and abuse leveled at Sandinista party leader Daniel Ortega by his stepdaughter. Soyla America Narváez formally filed sexual abuse charges before criminal court on May 27th, charging the 53-year-old Ortega with rape, sexual assault, and continual abuse from 1978 to 1998. Daniel Ortega has denied the charges. Other Sandinista leaders have accused Narváez of mounting a campaign to discredit Ortega for political reasons. Hecklers outside the court branded her a liar and crazy, while supporters, mostly women, linked arms around her protectively and responded by chanting justice. Party leaders also closed ranks around Ortega, recently re-electing him Secretary General. Ortega has legal immunity as a member of the National Assembly, but Liberal Party legislators have said he could be stripped of that protection.
In Peru, President Alberto Fujimori has decreed a 30-day amnesty for holders of illegal arms, warning them to hand over their weapons or face drastic prison sentences. Using controversial emergency powers to fight increasingly violent organized crime, Fujimori imposed jail sentences of up to 15 years for offenders and lifetime sentences for those robbing weapons from security forces. The decree is the latest passed this month after Fujimori vowed to treat serious criminals as, quote, terrorists, applying the same harsh laws used to crush guerrilla groups in the early 90s. Included in the package was an order to reinvigorate the practice of summary military trials and a proposed constitutional change to allow police to detain criminal suspects for up to 15 days without charging them. Human rights groups are charging that these same kind of measures led to Peru's infamous faceless military courts, which jailed as many as 1,000 innocent people who are still suffering inhumane conditions in maximum security prisons.
And those are some of the stories coming out of Latin America this week. For Our Americas, I'm Sarah Gill.
And I'm Walter Krockmal.
And you're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. In other news this week, U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen wrapped up his recent trip to South America on May 27th, saying that the danger of a military arms race in the region is, quote, virtually non-existent because of growing cooperation and improving relations among Latin American nations. At a press conference in Brasilia, Cohen told reporters that the United States is not interested in contributing to any arms race in Latin America or elsewhere, but that the U.S. would be willing to cooperate with any country in the region seeking military advice. Speaking primarily of Argentina, Brazil, and Chile, Cohen said they're all democracies now and have not only the ability but also the obligation to provide for their individual defenses. Joining us now to discuss Cohen's visit and public pronouncements is Rachel Stoll, who's a research analyst with the Center for Defense Information based in Washington, D.C. Rachel, is Cohen right in saying that there's no potential for an arms race in Latin America today?
I certainly think that there is a potential for an arms race in Latin America. I think once you introduce an unstable element like a new level of sophistication, with the F-16s, for example, to Chile, I think it's a sophistication not needed in that region. I think that the ban on high-tech weapon sales that has existed in that region for many years should continue in order to prevent an arms race and an attempt to increase the level of sophistication in the region.
Well, you're referring to something that occurred last year, and in fact, I was going to ask you what impact did the Clinton administration's announcement last year to lift that ban, which has been in effect, had been in effect since the Carter administration, of selling high-tech weapons to Latin American countries. If you can see if there has been any impact so far, 1 year after the fact, of that lift.
I think that certainly we're seeing the potential for destabilization in the region. Brazil has indicated that it would like to buy up to 150 advanced fighters by 2005. Argentina is now talking about updating their fighter jets because they have been they've received this major non-NATO ally status by the United States. And again, Chile is attempting to update its old U.S. A-37 fighter jets and is discussing purchasing either the U.S. F-16 or F-18s or perhaps jets made in Sweden and France.
So the question remains, what is the purpose? Why do you think these countries need, I mean, at this stage of the game, if their democracy is flourishing and if there's stability in the region, why would they need these high-tech weapons?
I certainly think part of it is a status in the region. There's a lot of other issues in Latin America, such as crime, drug trafficking, that receive quite a bit of press and that these weapons don't really address those problems. And so I think there's an effort to kind of modernize their militaries to perhaps show that they are attempting to address some of the issues in the region and the country, and at the same time be prepared for a potential regional or international threat.
In terms of the uses of the military traditionally in Latin America, especially over the last 20, 25 years, the impact of the military has been felt more internally, not in terms of defending borders. In a few occasions, sure, Brazil Brazil, with Ecuador, Peru, and some of the other border conflicts that have occurred. But for the most part, they have been used internally, and we see that as an increasing trend, that the police are being used for, I mean, the military are being used for police, internal policing. Is there any danger in terms of this kind of push to sell and get this kind of upgrade, weapon system upgrades, that they might be used internally in Latin America?
Well, I certainly think that any time you kind of have a militarization of society, that is dangerous for democracy and peace and stability. So I think that certainly there is the potential for these weapons to be used internally rather than in an international conflict, although, I would say that an F-18 is not going to be the weapon of choice by the government to use against the internal population. I think that, you know, normally you would think of tanks or machine guns, those kinds of things being used against the population. But certainly that could present a danger.
Now, where do you think this impetus is coming from to expand the or to enhance the militarization, the military capacities of these countries? Maybe you can give us some insight into the weapons contractors and the major U.S. weapons manufacturers. Do they have a stake in all this?
Oh, absolutely. I think with the end of the Cold War, weapons contractors are always looking for new markets where they can sell their weapons. And as their regional and sub-regional initiatives and even international initiatives to perhaps have a code of conduct regarding arms sales to areas which perhaps have questionable human rights practices, or the end user is not exactly clear who will be receiving those weapons, I think certainly defense contractors see their market shrinking and are very eager to have as many markets open to them as possible to sell these high-tech and very expensive weapons so that they can make a profit.
Now, with these, and you refer to the end use agreements that have been forced upon a number of countries, in terms of weapon sales, are there any end use agreements signed, or is that specifically relating to U.S. military aid? Direct aid to those countries?
I believe it's military aid.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if there are any end-use certificates already signed. I know that there are discussions in the works. Cohen has repeatedly said that he is having discussions with high-level officials in that region regarding the purchasing of various weapon systems. But to be honest, I'm not sure if there are any actual certificates signed in place. I certainly believe that we should welcome the democracy and demilitarization of the societies in these countries in Latin America. However, I think that the U.S. role should be to encourage social and economic development first, and focus on the poverty and education in those countries. Certainly, providing new weapon systems to that region has a destabilizing effect, and is a misallocation of valuable resources in those countries. I think that these are not first world economies, and they shouldn't be spending their money on first world weapons.
Rachel Stoll is a research analyst with the Center for Defense Information based in Washington, D.C., and you're listening to Our Americas. Mexican human rights groups are blasting the government of Ernesto Zedillo for not granting a visa to an official of a U.S. group that enraged the authorities by organizing reality tours of the troubled state of Chiapas. The groups are saying the government might even be breaking the law by barring Ted Lewis, a director of the San Francisco-based Global Exchange, in the latest move in what political analysts call a tougher stance over the conflict between government supporters and pro-Indian rebels in the state of Chiapas. It's just one bit of news coming out of Mexico this week. Joining us now to talk about these and other developments is veteran journalist John Ross, a regular contributor to Our Americas and the author of the book The Annexation of Mexico from the Aztecs to the IMF. John, I guess we can say the crackdown on foreigners doesn't seem to be slowing down, right?
No, in fact, they're in the process of issuing new rules and regulations restricting the stay in country of human rights observers, the number of people you can have on a team, doing background checks. They've completely closed the door on the sending of delegations into Chiapas, Guerrero, and Oaxaca. This has been brewing for a number of months. There have been, since the massacre at Acteal, way back in December, on December 22nd, 71 foreigners have been thrown out of the country. Just a couple of weeks ago, on May 11th, 40 Italians, the most drastic action ever taken by Mexican immigration, 40 Italians were put on a plane that the government actually rented and thrown out of the country and barred from ever coming back. nonetheless, there are in country right now several human rights delegations in Chiapas, and over the next couple of months, a number of other delegations will be coming to the country to test the new regulations and to move into areas in Chiapas where foreign human rights observers are systematically being excluded from.
How this has been playing in the Mexican press, I would imagine there is some sympathy to the foreigners, but at the same time, is there sympathy to the position that the government has taken?
I think it, you know, basically it's broken down along party lines. Those people that support human rights and support the indigenous people and support the Separatist Army of National Liberation and other organizations of indigenous farmers basically think it's a good thing. I think that foreign observers need to keep coming to country because they get the international attention, and they have the influence in terms of providing the kind of pressures against the Mexican government, particularly Europeans. The European Union is negotiating a free trade treaty with Mexico, and there have been a number of delegations of European Parliament members, and in addition to the Italians, people from many countries in Europe, and they have raised the issue of human rights abuses in the European Parliament in terms of negotiating this free trade treaty with Mexico. So, in a real sense, this whole wave of xenophobia that we've been seeing in the last couple of months definitely comes from the Cedillo administration, comes from the functionaries of the Cedillo administration, and that government just doesn't have very much credibility. So, in a real sense, I think that the feelings about the observers has broken down along those general lines, those people that support the government and those people that don't support the government. It's interesting, though, that this week, kind of the new wrinkle on xenophobia has been a broad attack on the exploits of U.S. governmental agents in Mexico, U.S. governmental agencies. As a result of the this investigation, which was dubbed Casablanca White House, of money laundering in Mexican banks, apparently several U.S. agents crossed into Mexico and conducted investigations without government permission. So the same kind of ferocity that has been turned on the Italians and the French, the human rights observers come from 15 different countries, is now being aimed directly at the Treasury Department, Robert Rubin, Janet Reno. They're the pet targets of this particular week.
Mm-hmm. And on Wednesday, Mike McCurry said that President Clinton called Zedillo to apologize for that incident, which was involving, unilateral attempt at dealing with money laundering through Mexico, and obviously the Mexican government was quite upset about it. But speaking of cracking down, the crackdown on foreigners in Chiapas specifically is coming, but is it coming alongside the crackdown on paramilitaries and other forces within Mexico that are conducting sweeps of areas, like as we saw in December, Actial, or is that something that has kind of fallen now by the wayside?
Mario, since December 22nd, since the day of the massacre at Actial, 46 people were killed, there has not been one paramilitary organization put on the spot. Its members have been arrested. The organization has been dismantled. In the Chenalhó municipality in Chiapas, where the massacre took place, about 100 members of the PRI have been taken into custody, and they are currently in Cerro Hueco. That's only one of 10, perhaps 11 or 12 paramilitary organizations that are operating in the state. Just yesterday, members of Peace and Justice, a very unaptly named organization, paramilitary organization north of the state, opened fire on four members of Zapatista base community and wounded them. These are daily occurrences in the state of Chiapas. Just yesterday, again, a camp was found near Tenajapa in the highlands that's being attributed to the Zapatistas as a training camp. I think we're going to see the same kind of effort to kind of influence public opinion here that we saw a couple of months ago when a similar camp was found down near the jungle in Chiltik. Both of these are obviously been staged by the military. In both cases, they said they've found Separatista propaganda, but it's just really being utilized to up the ante here and to prepare the public for a military attack on the Separatistas.
Are you saying that there is an imminent attack to dismantle the Separatista military capacity?
Let's say this, Mario, because we have said this so many times, and I think, you know, it gets to a point where we begin to cry wolf a bit here. But the situation is such that the military is poised to move on the Comandancia of the EZLN on any given morning. They're no further than 10 kilometers away from where the camps of the Comandancia are in the mountains. There are elite troops prepared to go in and take out the Comandancia. It has not, to this point, been politically feasible for Cedillo to do that. But on the other hand, keeping the Separatistas on edge like this, with the constant rumor that military attacks are about to be launched, is a real part of the low-intensity warfare that the Mexican government, with the aid of the United States, has been waging against the Separatist Army of National Liberation. What will change this situation, hopefully, in the next couple of weeks, is the rainy season. The country, as you may know, is enveloped in huge clouds of smoke. We have over 11,000 forest fires burning in the country, many of them in Chiapas. And generally, when the rains start, things slow up. The military is not able to move, so the possibility of an attack lessens, and the tensions begin to relax a bit. Unfortunately, the rainy season may be very late this year. There's a tremendous drought that's affecting the entire country, south to north, and it gives the military that much more room to operate in.
I just want to remind the listeners that we're speaking with John Ross, who is a veteran journalist who has covered Mexico for many years. He's the author of a number of books on Mexico and the developing situation in Chiapas. His most recent book is called The Annexation of Mexico from the Aztecs to the IMF. John, I just wanted you to maybe talk a little bit more about the military crackdown and wonder if maybe we can kind of get into the heads of the Mexican military leadership. Reading from a AP report from May 27th, it says a soldier was being held on charges of training the gunmen who massacred 45 Indians in the southern hamlet of Actial in December. Mariano Perez Ruiz, who is from a village near Actial, will be tried on a weapons charge in a civilian court because he was on a two-week leave when he allegedly trained gunmen linked to Mexico's ruling party. First of all, what is the significance of this detention, and is this sort of a blemish on the military overall, or is this something that the military establishment doesn't really pay much attention to?
It is important. The fact is that the gentleman in question comes from a neighboring village. He's a Tzotzil Indian. The question still remains, where did these guns come from? Where was the money made available? How was the money made available in order to provide both training and weaponry for those people, those members of the paramilitary organization Máscara Roja, or Red Mask, on December 22nd. We have, as I said, over 100 people in jail right now for the Actial massacre. None of them is a member of the establishment. We're talking about over 100 Tzotzil Indians, all of the members of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, but we don't know who. We have suspicions, but certainly don't see an investigation taking this up into the hierarchy, to the ex-governor of the state of Chiapas and his underlings, where clearly these orders were originated. The development of paramilitary organizations in the state of Chiapas is an outgrowth of a plan that the military developed in 1994, the Chiapas Campaign Plan, to develop paramilitary organizations to face off against the Zapatistas in the 38 municipalities that they have influence in. So since the beginning, it's been the military objective to create these paramilitaries, and we would assume to arm and to train them as well. Now, here we have a soldier who was on leave, who was training members of a paramilitary organization to massacre upwards of 40 people up in the highlands of Chiapas. I think it's significant that this happened. It's not... The arrest hasn't made very much of a splash in the Mexican newspapers. It's been expected for a long time, and this has been common knowledge that the military was training the paramilitary organizations. But it is significant in the sense that the military is now, the military's feet are now being put to the fire in terms of their role in this massacre and in massacres to come, because I have no doubt, given the kinds of tensions that exist in the state of Chiapas, that we're going to see this happen again and again. And certainly we've seen it happen again and again, not only in Chiapas, but in Guerrero, in Mexican states in the south with large indigenous populations that are not in compliance with the way the government wants them to act. So I don't think that Acteal is going to be the last massacre that we're going to unfortunately read about in our daily newspapers.
Now, finally, John Ross, you referred to it earlier in your discussion, and this is something that has gotten a little bit of attention here in the United States, and that is the fire is burning out of control. It seems that Mexico is literally burning and figuratively burning up. What can you tell us about that, and what kind of impact is this having on the long term, including on the economic front?
Well, specifically, for example, in Chiapas, take a look at the jungle. The jungle is burning. The military is being deployed to cut off the fire to build fire breaks. They're doing it in Zapatista communities, and Zapatistas are claiming that the military is using these inroads into the communities as a pretext to establish their presence within the actual Zapatista communities themselves. I have no doubt that this is going on. The fires generally have been in the south, from all the way from the Yucatan, Chiapas, Oaxaca, up to Mexico City. They're absolutely horrendous. It's a conflagration. As I said, there's over 11,000 fires. They've combined with continuing explosions from the Popocatépetl volcano, and there's the Pacayal volcano in Guatemala, so that's up in the air, in addition to probably the worst contamination that we've seen in Mexico City as a result of auto emissions and man-made contamination in Mexico City itself. Visibility here is nil. We're in the third day of an environmental emergency. People have been asked not to drive, but they're still driving. And people have been told not to go outside of their house. It's quite a frightening situation, actually. And that's true in all of the major cities in Mexico at this point, covered with a dense cap of smoke. Airports are closed down. And it adds a little psychological, I think, tension to the political situation. It's almost like a metaphor for the political situation, not only in Chiapas, but in many other places in the countryside in Mexico, and makes the situation that much more murky, if we can say.
Veteran journalist John Ross is author of the book The Annexation of Mexico from the Aztecs to the IMF. He's a regular contributor to Our Americas. And you're listening to Our Americas. Our Americas is produced at the studios of WBAI, Pacifica Radio, in cooperation with NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. If you have any questions for us, you can send us an email at mmcompa@igc.org. That's mmcompa@igc.org. I'm Mario Murillo. Stay with us.